Welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante. He is Steve Pavlik. Steve, how'd you survive a weekend without Penn State football?
Spent a lot of time with my toddlers. You had a good weekend to go apple picking. It really wasn't the best weekend of college football games on. But yeah, just get a little time with the family is never a bad thing.
No, it's not. Well, because I don't have a life, I watched a lot of college football. It was actually kind of interesting for me because my day wasn't wrapped up around the Penn State game. So it was a chance to flip around to different games. A couple things that I came away with were, first of all, I love these rivalry games where it's, you could tell the teams really don't like each other. I don't know if you saw anything from this Colorado State game. The players didn't have anything nice to say about each other, which is fine. That's okay. But the coaches were going at it too. Steve, I love that about college football.
I actually watched a good bit of the backyard brawl. I know as a Penn State fan, I'm not supposed to root for Pitt. And obviously I don't when they play each other, but I did find myself sort of rooting for Pitt in that game. And I was surprised that they were able to make that comeback. But you said, you just see that level of intensity, that level of hatred that sort of comes to the forefront there in a rivalry that always makes them exciting. Even if you're just sort of an uninterested fan, you can just pick up on that.
What's fascinating is this is the second show I'm doing this week, okay? The first one was with Chris Buchanani, who hates Pitt so much that it turned him into a West Virginia hater for the way they played, okay? He was just so disgusted with West Virginia for blowing the lead. Me personally, now you have the opposite, you know, rooting for Pitt. I don't know if you do you have some kind of connection to Pitt.
I do. I mentioned one of my uncles went to Penn State. Okay. The other one went to Pitt. So in Johnstown, that's about half the distance between Penn State or State College and Pittsburgh, and very much a town, and in our case, a family divided.
Well, so that's okay. To me, that's a legitimate reason to be that way. Me personally, I really don't have any love for either team. Didn't really have a rooting interest. I just watched the game to watch college football and have fun with it. I thought the Pitt quarterback really showed himself really well. But what's interesting is Pat Narduzzi, I don't know if you saw his interview after the game. Steve, the man can't help himself. He just really cannot help himself. Well, I'm proud of my team because we beat West Virginia and we beat the officials also. So it was, you know, the official, you could think that all you want, but when you're in a coach on a national TV broadcast, that's not the first thing you say after the game. And of course, when they interview the West Virginia coach, mention it to him, he declares that that's BS, and he didn't use the acronym, and he goes off on how the officials screwed them also. So that's what's fun about college football.
I agree. No, what's not fun, though, is the poor officiating. That tends to be, unfortunately, a theme we have each week.
That is the case. And watching some games, it seems like offensive pass interference is sort of the thing now that it has become a controversial call. And as we saw in the Penn State game where Omari Evans seems to have the issue. There's been a couple plays, one where they called it, one where they did not, where officiating, sometimes you look for little keys or indicators, and it's always the arm extending as you push the defender away is kind of the key for offensive pass interference. But it seems different, though, when both players are engaged in the contact, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, if they're both engaged in the contact, I'm almost more inclined to put the burden on the defense. Oftentimes, sort of the defender is the one that initiates it. I think that was sort of the issue with Evans and maybe the non-call in the West Virginia game.
I think it was too. I think it was the defender who initiated contact, but also when contact is both guys kind of going at it, I think my tendency is let them play.
I agree.
And you know, who is getting, if neither guy is getting the great advantage over it, although I'm assuming that's what some folks would argue Omari Evans was doing by extending his arm. But you're right. The other thing seems to be placing the ball. We've seen that a couple weeks in a row with Penn State. I've seen it in other games where the officials on the field are not even close, and then the replay officials don't get it right either.
I mean, the side judge, that's his only job. And you have the replay. I mean, as you pointed out, I think a few times now, that's the most disturbing thing of all. It's one thing to miss it, you know, in the heat of a moment in a quick game, maybe your eyes elsewhere. I have some sympathy for that, even though, again, I think that's your job. But the fact that you review this and somehow maybe just the bias is, well, it's going to be difficult for us to, with undisputable evidence, to overturn the call on the field. It's just disappointing. And I'll point out, too, I mean, you have a lot of people now with a lot of money on these games. And I think I'd be surprised if you don't see more of an outsized interest here to try to get these calls a little more accurate.
Yes, you wish that they could do a better job. And I don't, when they miss that badly, though, I just wonder about the training. And you see it where there becomes points of emphasis. And what I was talking about with the offensive pass interference, it feels like the point of emphasis is, hey, if the offensive player extends his arms, pushing away the defensive player, that's what you're looking for. But the just plain missing, marking the ball, that's the one that's like, you know, it is so black and white. This is what you do. Where did the guy go down? Where's the ball? And again, sometimes it's hard, like, oh, at what point did his knee hit the ground and where's the ball versus then he falls the rest of the way to the ground. But the couple plays we've seen, it's been nothing like that. It's just been horrendous spotting, like a yard or two off.
Yeah, it's inexplicable. And again, the fact that the replay people aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing and making up for the bad missed call on the field, that I really don't get.
No, I don't either. But we're going to get to where Penn State talk, but we sort of got ourselves off in this other direction. So I want to keep going this way, though, with the games this weekend. I know you were with the family much of the time, but there were a couple talking points for me coming out of it. And as I'm these rivalry games, I've been okay with the change in the leagues, you know, to selfishly as a member of the Big Ten. I want to see more games against Oregon and USC, more big games. But if it's at the expense of some of these rivalries, like we saw this weekend, like I said, Colorado, Colorado State, Washington, Washington State, Oregon, Oregon State, West Virginia, Pitt game, these rivalries from places that there's split fan base because the schools are close enough. As they get rid of those, I miss that. Candidly, Steve, now you're one with some connection to Pitt also. I miss Penn State versus Pitt.
Again, there was no question who I was rooting for when they had that series. But as someone who went to, I believe, three of the four of the games, that was an exciting thing to be a part of. Because, again, you could feel the real hatred and animosity, the house divided, you know, with half the family that went to one school talking a lot of trash to the other. You just can't replicate that. And unfortunately, I sort of share your concern that this may be one of the things that we lose as a result of this expansion. Now, maybe at some point things will expand so far to the point where maybe some of these rivalries will eventually be renewed. But again, that's sort of something I fear, at least in the near term, we're going to lose.
Well, I
get Penn State's perspective, though, not wanting to play Pitt. I mean, candidly, Penn State has nothing to gain and everything to lose. That's sort of what you saw in 16, where, you know, they come back a little too late. And as a result, it cost them a chance to make the playoff. And, you know, when they beat Pitt, that's sort of what they're expected to do. It's one to sort of watch it irritate Narduzzi, which, you know, even I can appreciate. But still, I mean, I sort of understand Penn State perspective as to what do we really have to gain here.
And it does make sense, and it's logical as a Penn State fan. But as much as I hate to say it, if you look at this from the bigger picture as just a college football fan, the fact that Pitt's season could be made by winning that game and keeping Penn State from making the playoffs, that's an exciting element of college football. It's a huge element. And that's what I have a problem with is these teams are doing – teams, leagues, they're doing the best things for themselves. But is it the best thing for college football in general? And you don't have the czar of college football who could step in and say, you know what? It's not quite right having Alabama playing pure Prairie Valley A&M and winning the game 80-0. That's not good for college football. So we should take steps to avoid those kind of games.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I sort of understand most things I think at this point now in college football are driven by money. And unfortunately, I think that's where the direction is headed. But even for Prairie View Valley, I mean, they tend to make a lot of money by coming up there to play Alabama. I've heard the argument made, and they say that some of these schools may not be able to continue with football if they aren't able to sort of get these big paydays from going against some of the big boys. I don't know how true that is. I'm not close enough to that. But intuitively, that sort of makes some sense to me. But yeah, again, unfortunately, I think it's about the money. We've talked a lot of debate here and in other shows about whether Notre Dame could still make the playoff after losing to Northern Illinois. The bottom line is if they go undefeated, Notre Dame brings a lot of eyeballs, which brings a lot of money. So as much as I don't think they should be able to qualify for the playoffs after losing at home to Northern Illinois, I suspect if it comes down to the playoff committee and they're in a position where they can sort of argue to put Notre Dame in, they're going to just because of the money.
And see, now I look at that one, and we've talked about this a little bit. If Notre Dame wins out and finishes 11-1, I don't think there's any way they keep him out. And I'm not sure that I have an issue with that, because I think the committee does look at wins and losses probably first before they look at anything else.
Well, the wins really won't mean anything. You look at their schedule, it's pretty soft. Now, you'll look at USC at the end. I think we're going to find out a lot more about USC when they play Michigan, and obviously they're going to play Penn State too. So maybe that win will mean more. Maybe that'll sort of be a de facto playoff game for both of them. They could potentially be trying to compete for one of those few remaining playoff spots.
All right, we're going to pick up the conversation from there. I have a couple of solutions for it when we come back, Steve. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and Cafe Tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
It's quarter number two on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello, welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's Steve, I'm Jim. We're talking college football in general after a bye week for the Nittany Lions. And we were talking about how we end up maybe losing some of these rivalries like Oregon, Oregon State, even Pitt, West Virginia. And the answer, as Steve points out, it's usually money. Money is the answer. Some of these lower level teams who are cannon fodder for the good teams, like Kent State, played Tennessee and lost 71-0. Okay. But they got a payday. So that's part of it. So you want the solution, Steve?
Sure.
Here we go. This is the solution. I wish there were a czar of college football, but there isn't. But the power is in the legal, the Big Ten, the Southeast Conference. I wish they would get together and say, you know what? Minimum 9 conference games. SEC's been getting away with that 8 conference games forever, which then gives you 3 out of conference games. You know what? 2 out of the 3 games you got to play against a power conference team. Now, you don't have to go against Alabama or Georgia, but you got to at least have a team with a pulse. Then you're allowed one game, so everybody gets paid. You could play Delaware. You could play Kent State. You could play everybody, whoever you want. Have it as a home game. So if you're the big team, you make the payday that way. And if you're Northern Illinois or Kent State or Prairie Valley, you get your $1 million payoff. But because that will limit the number of those games, how about this? We always complain about, you know, the blue-white game, the spring game. How about if they were allowed to bring in an outside team for the spring game? So your own players don't have to keep hitting each other. If you're Penn State, maybe you bring in Delaware. But wait a minute, Jim. If it's live action, someone's going to get hurt. Well, you know what? You're playing Delaware. Don't play your starters. Play your third string guys. Give them some actual playing time. I think as a fan, that would be more enjoyable to me. Delaware gets something of a payday. The Delaware players get to play in a big stadium in front of a pretty big crowd. There's your solution, Steve. What do you say?
It's not the worst idea I've heard.
Well, you know, that's – but the funny thing is they have not come to me asking me the question, so –
Not yet.
Not yet. So I'm waiting on the phone call. All right. Let's take a look at Penn State now as we're heading into the bye week. I think, Steve, going into the season, we all had certain concerns. We weren't sure how they would turn out. And not necessarily did we get an answer yet through two games, but I think we're starting to get a feel for it. So let's go at some of the things. If we did this show prior to the season, these are the things I think we would be talking about. Let's start with new coordinators, both sides of the ball. Let's start with Andy Kotelnicki. The big thing coming in was we needed someone who could create explosive plays with this offense. How do you think Andy Kotelnicki has done so far?
I mean, he's exceeded my expectations, and you know, they were actually pretty decent. I know some of them maybe viewed as sour Steve, and you know, I had some questions given a lot of the hype around Yurcich coming in as the offense coordinator than Shiraka before that. So I was sort of, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. But right now, seeing's believing. He has schemed open these plays, and usually when the offense has stopped themselves, has been either because somebody dropped a pass, an interception, or a penalty. I don't necessarily blame Kotelnicki for those things. So on the offensive side, I've been pleasantly surprised. I guess where I would look at the defensive coordinator hire in Tom Allen, if you asked me after the first game, yeah, I would have said this was great. This was sort of, you know, again, sort of meets or exceeds expectations. Obviously, I have a lot of questions now after at least the first half and even some in the second half with respect to that hire in terms of how the team looked last week. So, you know, I think that's maybe an incomplete at this point. And then special teams, you know, I thought – first game, there's some questions there, maybe putting too much emphasis on the missed field goal. I thought for the most part, though, in the second game, you know, they looked pretty good. So, again, probably two incompletes at the other two. But for Kotelnicki, I would say maybe an A-.
Well, let's drill down a little bit at what we were looking at in the offense with him. I'll tell you, I just looked this up. And I don't know if this statistic surprises you any at all. I looked at the number of passing plays versus number of running plays and the ratio. You care to guess what that ratio looks like just off the top of your head?
I think it's going to be 2-1 running to passing. I don't know that they've thrown the ball that much, but I guess it's a shot in the dark.
That's pretty accurate. There were 79 carries, 79 rushes, and 38 passing attempts, so almost exactly 2-1. Now, again, there's a couple of the carries when the quarterback goes back to pass and ends up either being sacked or running with the ball, that's considered a rushing attempt. So it has been about 2-1. And with such an emphasis on getting explosive plays, does that surprise you at all?
Maybe. I just going back to the games. I mean, they're two different, just the way the numbers, you know, sort of get skewed a little bit. For instance, you know, West Virginia, Penn State had that commanding lead, particularly when Singleton took it to the house there to start the third quarter. So it made sense to run the ball to sort of run out the clock the latter part of that game. against Bowling Green, the offense, for the most part, was able to move the ball at will, as you would expect. Again, it was a situation where they stopped themselves. So if you're having success on the ground, particularly against an overmatched opponent, to me, it would make sense to sort of stick with the run. But, you know, they're delivering some explosive plays with the running game. I think Singleton's another one that sort of returning almost to freshman form, where, you know, he's delivering these home runs almost expectedly now. Reminds me a little bit of Saquon Barkley, where, you know, he may get stopped for a few times, but you can guarantee at some point of the game he's going to rattle off a big one. And that can change the complexion of the game. So that's another area where I've been probably more pleasantly surprised, is Singleton maybe getting out of that sophomore slump.
And the numbers really prove it out too with the running game, and I like how they've stuck with it and they're successful with it. I pointed out in the Bowling Green game, combined Catron Allen and Nick Singleton had 8 carries of over 10 yards each. So that just proves the point.
Well, I think good coordinators sort of play to their strengths. And I think, objectively speaking, the strength of the team coming in this year was the running game. I know there's a lot of hope with Aller. And again, I think he's somebody else that's exceeded expectations, but they're still at best an incomplete on the wide receivers. So to me, it makes sense that Kotelnicki would try to lean on these two good running backs and at some point sort of run to set up the pass. And again, to me, there's a lot of strategy to what he's doing. He makes good in-game schematic adjustments. So I've been pleasantly surprised. And, you know, I'm confident that this will probably be a continued trend through the rest of the season.
I think if they're successful running the ball, hey, you stick with it. And you've got two very good running backs. Our biggest concern was the wide receivers going in. And, you know, you had Trey Wallace with the big game against West Virginia. Bowling Green, if we want to lump the tight ends in together with the wide receivers and just say, hey, the receivers, it was Tyler Warren who had the big game against Bowling Green. How are you feeling now about the wide receivers specifically and receivers in general versus how you felt before the season started?
Well, I keep the tight end separate from that conversation just because I thought that Warren would be a tremendous asset to the team, and he definitely showed that again, Bowling Green. Going back to sort of, you know, when you're going up against other teams, you're going to try to take something away. My sense was that Bowling Green wasn't going to get beat deep, getting lost to Wallace after watching the West Virginia tape, and Kotelnicki was smart enough to sort of pivot and use Warren more. So I like the fact that there's a balanced offense there. But at this point, yeah, it's 2 games in. I think there's still a lot of questions at wide receiver. Obviously, Wallace showed some encouraging signs against West Virginia. Evans at the time has had flashes of plays, but, you know, he's also, you know, dropped a critical pass. Obviously had the pass interference call last week. So those are things that can be corrected. So there's reason for hope. But, you know, I'm waiting to see, you know, what the wide receivers do against some more formidable defenses once we start in conference play, and that'll be coming up. So, you know, at best, I had a question about what was going to be there at wide receiver. I think those questions at this point still remain. But I've been encouraged with what I've seen so far. It's just, you know, can you continue to build on that progress? And I'd say be a little more consistent moving forward.
Would you, are you concerned at all that Julian Fleming came in? We all know, big name coming in. He's had 2 targets total in 2 games. And Liam Clifford, who we were told was one of the guys separating himself in camp, I don't think he's been targeted yet.
Well, I mean, with Fleming, I was sort of skeptical that he was going to be his a number one receiver. The idea that Ohio State's number 4 receiver is going to somehow come to Penn State and be some transcendent number one receiver. Again, I was sort of always, I think, a little skeptical that that was going to happen. I think where Fleming and Clifford may be making a bigger impact, candidly, is blocking for the run game. And that shouldn't be overlooked. I mean, if they're on the field and you can block those guys at the second level, that may be one of the reasons that Singleton's having some success in breaking these long runs. So I don't want to diminish that. That's something that I always thought Chris Godwin and others on that Saquon Barkley team, you know, didn't get the credit they deserved in, you know, getting to that second level and opening up some of those really long runs. But I sort of look at the package. I mean, at this point, I think you're sort of looking at Wallace as the one receiver, Evans as the number 2. I don't know that it makes sense to take Warren and maybe another one of the tight ends off the field. So, you know, I don't have done the snap count, but the fact that they don't might not have a third wide receiver out there when you have a strength of tight ends, maybe keep that defense guessing. Are they going to run? Are they going to pass? Maybe there's something to that.
I look at Tyler Warren as just such a weapon that, yeah, I don't want him off the field. And again, you look at, you know, are there plays where you can get both running backs on the field at the same time? And again, I look at it, those are weapons. So why not have them both out there? And I've pointed this out before, and I think it's worth mentioning again, some of these questions about wide receiver and getting the ball distributed is you got to remember how few passes were thrown in these first two games. And I think what's fascinating to me is Connor Bazelak, he threw more passes in the Bowling Green Penn State game than Drew Aller has thrown in the two games combined against West Virginia and Bowling Green, Steve.
Again, you know, that sort of goes back to the scheme and the flow of the game. I mean, you know, I think one thing that's sort of the jury in terms of the playbook being out on Penn State, I don't think it's a coincidence that both West Virginia and Bowling Green are trying to hold on to the ball and sustain these long drives. And that's why you don't see Penn State with time of possession nearly that the other teams do. I mean, I think the logic is if we're holding on to the ball, Penn State can't score on us. And I think that's probably going to be something that you probably see other teams try to emulate moving forward. Not necessarily Kent State, but I'm thinking more against Illinois coming up.
I think that could be the case, too. We'll start to talk about that when we come back. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Let's get back to the action on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's Steve, I'm Jim. We're talking about Penn State during this bye week, what's going on. And between segments, Steve and I were talking about some of the elements of this is the opposing team and what they're trying to do to you. And Steve, you were talking about the point of, especially if you're an underdog, if you can't talent up with the team you're up against, is maybe limiting the number of possessions is the way to go. Now, you can't go three and out and limit your opponent's possessions. But if you could play the game in such a way where you're holding on to the ball for a while, that limits your opponent's possessions.
Absolutely. I mean, that's essentially, we're talking about Pitt Penn State at the beginning. I mean, that's what Pitt did in 2017, where they were facing a very prolific Penn State offense. And there's some method to the madness. I think part of it, too, now you sort of see how things evolve. You know, early on, I think when Chip Kelly was sort of coming on the scene, he would sort of run these very fast tempo offense with the idea that, you know, the defense couldn't substitute and get off the field. Now we're sort of at the other extreme where you have teams really taking, I believe, to like the last second to try to make these adjustments in the defense accordingly. So taking all this time trying to change the play and get the ultimate call in usually means that there's only a second or two left, which I think if you probably look at college football as a whole, there are probably fewer plays being run compared to just a few years ago, which I think puts even more emphasis on the offense to utilize that. Because if you're going to have fewer possessions, you really need to make sure that you're making the most out of them.
Well, if you look at, you know, Bowling Green in the first half, they had two 10 play drives. Just doing that alone, your possession time, each one of those was over 5 minutes. Combined, that's over 10 minutes of the, I think they were both in the first quarter. Yes, they were. There's the vast majority of the quarter gone without letting Penn State on the field. And that's the way to do it. And we're probably seeing more evidence of that in games. I didn't see all of the game. I saw a bit of it, but you know, Kentucky playing Georgia, you just have to look at the stats for the end of the game and the score at the end of the game. And they held Georgia, get this, Georgia had a total of 65 yards in the first half, Steve.
Yeah, they probably didn't have the ball that often either, whereas Kentucky was sustaining these drives. So, you know, I mean, it's not at the end of the day, you know, like we've talked about this before, one of the things that's great about football from the schematic perspective is there's always a counter to whatever the other team's trying to do or take away. And I think seeing how different teams prepare for the week, sort of what they see on film, and then how they're able to make those adjustments during the game, to me is always very interesting as a fan.
Well, let's hit this a little bit of making those adjustments. I thought, first of all, Bowling Green in that first half, it was just a wonderful game plan executed like crazy by their offense. It was a short passing game, get the ball away before Penn State's vaunted, you know, defensive ends could get to the quarterback. They ran short routes, and they had a quarterback who executed it perfectly. And, you know, I guess the question is, you know, did Penn State adjust quickly enough? It seemed to wait till halftime before they made adjustments. And is that something future teams are going to look at? Future teams are going to play Penn State, going to look at that and say, aha, here's a way to attack them.
It is hard to make in-game adjustments as opposed to sort of regrouping, getting everybody on the same page with the different position groups at halftime. I will grant that. You know, that said, I mean, Bowling Green, to their credit, they had something on film. They went out and executed that. And the quarterback, he's not a guy without talent. You said he was an SEC Big Ten quarterback before. Obviously, he's been around a while, so you see a thing or two. Going up against his former coach, he may have had a sense as to some things to maybe look for. But again, I don't have a lot of sympathy for letting Bowling Green just sort of sustain these 10-play drives repeatedly in the first half. I know it's difficult to make adjustments. That said, you're getting paid a lot of money. You're working with these kids during the week. I'm still disappointed in what I saw the first half.
I am too, and I wonder if they're – and I've been accused of being a Manny Diaz fanboy. Guilty as charged, Steve, okay? And it was always a very aggressive defense. And there was some thought, and I kind of understand this, that maybe they needed to back off a little bit with, you know, sending that many people. You do leave yourself vulnerable at times and might it need to be a little more selective. But I was watching that game and saying to myself, you know what? Maybe they need to disrupt this rhythm that Bowling Green has. They're just marching down the field. Do something. Send extra players. Get them out of their rhythm. Force something.
Actually, I think blitzing him may have made things worse. I mean, he was getting the ball out so quick, and that was sort of by design. I mean, if one thing, they have linebackers out of position and give up long plays. Another thing, they have guys that blitz and still don't get there, and now there's nobody to make that tackle. So, you know, I had a lot of praise for Manny Diaz, but, you know, you live by the blitz, you die by the blitz. I think that sort of got exposed last year in the Michigan game where Penn State would have Michigan, you know, in third and long. A lot of times Michigan was sort of running out of these pass blitzes that Diaz was sending and was pretty effective in sustaining those drives. So, you know, I've heard this argument made that, you know, maybe Allen was trying to play this very vanilla defense, trying to not show his cards necessarily before he has to play USC. Again, I think you really ought to focus on just winning the game and, you know, deal with that when you get there. But, you know, we'll see. The important thing is that they made the adjustments in the second half. And you know, I think that's sort of the encouraging thing. And maybe the next step will be trying to accelerate the adjustment process.
Yes. And by the way, Jim here advocating for more blitzing. If you remember that one that touchdown pass, it was when they blitzed, and I'll give credit again to the quarterback. He was under pressure, and he threw a tremendous pass for that touchdown. So, in fact, I wonder, when I see a game like that and a quarterback impresses me so much, like he did with his performance, is I wonder just how good is he? And, you know, I want to say, gee, what would he be like on a, you know, when a Southeast Conference or a Big Ten team? My goodness, I wonder, Steve.
Well, I mean, he was at a Big Ten, a and Southeast Conference team. So that might give you some indication of how he was doing. But, like, I mean, the quarterback's a tough spot. Only one of them gets to play on the field, and it's definitely a carousel. I think it's only been accelerated now with NIL and the transfer portal. So a lot of these guys are going to play at multiple schools. I think he's just sort of a symptom rather than the cause of that. But, yeah, I mean, give credit. He went out there and he executed. But, again, Penn State shouldn't have allowed him to look like Dan Marino back there.
Exactly. But, again, with the quarterbacks, if you remember, Michael Penix was also a quarterback at Indiana. And when he ended up at Washington, there you go, a much, much different player. I wanted to ask you, again, going into the season, one of the big questions was Abdul Carter moving to defensive end. How do you think that experiment is going?
It's only two games into the season, but it's in the limited sample size. I think still probably more to be desired, but it's new to him. And, you know, there's hope that over time he's going to grow more comfortable into the role, taking on the run in terms of how he's blitzing different now that he has responsibility, not to lose contain, not to just sort of run up the field and let the guy step up. That's something I sort of seen on tape that I think can be corrected. But yeah, again, another incomplete. It was something that remained a question coming into the season. I think it still remains a question after 2 weeks.
Well, I also think, and here I am, I'm saying, yes, you know, I qualified, it's only two games, but let's make our rash conclusions anyway. But I think before the season, even in talking about coordinators, talking about Abdul Carter making a change of position, I think we said we wouldn't see the best of them in these first couple games because there it does take a while to acclimate. And I'm probably a little more willing to give Tom Allen some slack for the Bowling Green game, as much as I didn't like it, that, you know what? He's still getting the feel for the talent that he has. And it's much different talent than what he had at Indiana.
I think that's fair. But again, I'm curious actually to see how Carter looks against Illinois, a team that's probably just going to run right at him. And that'll be a good test to see, you know, if he's sort of evolved as a player at that point and can be effective. And then I think a couple weeks later, not necessarily UCLA, but going out to USC, I mean, that's where he will have a time or an opportunity to showcase his skills as a pass rusher. You know, that will be a perfect spot for him to do that. Whether he can do it effectively remains to be seen. Again, I just think at this point, it's a new position. It's been sort of tough to tell, too, when you're looking at some of the talent disparity, particularly at Bowling Green. How effective he's been. But there's hope, you know, that he'll settle in there soon.
Well, I'm with you. I'm really anxious to see the Illinois game. Before we get there, just in the interim to understand who Kent State is, they got beat like 71-0 by Tennessee. And I don't know if you saw this. I think it was like 65-0 at halftime. And there's a rule that they have in the NCAA, if both parties agree to it, you could shorten the game. And Tennessee went to Kent State and offered to shorten the game. And Kent State said, no, that's not our style. We're Kent State. We came here to play. I don't know if I give them credit for that or am I, I'll be critical for that, Steve.
Well, when you're down 65-0 at halftime, there's reasons to question the coach's judgment on a lot of levels. That just adds to that questionable judgment, I think.
I'm with you. Yes, it's 65-0. I don't think the comeback is not in the cards, okay, when you're down 65-0 at halftime. How about, you know, just run the clock or shorten the game, do something, and get me out of here.
Well, I hope Penn State, you know, I don't know if they're going to go 77-0, but, you know, I'd like to see a much different start to this game. You know, I'd like to come out and just sort of dominate both sides of the ball, sort of like we were hoping for Bowling Green. Get up early. Let's get some of these players, you know, that aren't starting more reps and come in healthy to Illinois. I mean, that's really what I want to see. I don't see the miscommunications, particularly on defense. Don't want to see the offense sort of, you know, stopping themselves, really just sort of show that you've learned some lessons here. It's been a couple, you know, difficult weeks probably in practice. You could argue it's maybe the best situation to still get the win, but plenty of things to correct.
All right, that is it for quarter number three. Stick around. We're going to finish strong with quarter four. Stay tuned. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
We head to the home stretch in quarter number four on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number four. Steve, with zero criticism of the team's performance this past week because they didn't play. They do have the bye week and then playing Kent State, and I don't want to hear the jokes about it being in, you know, just another MAC school like Bowling Green. Kent State is not Bowling Green. As I said, they're coming off a 70-point loss. It is literally a 50-point, I think it's like 51 or 52-point spread for this game. So I doubt we're going to learn much against Kent State. I think what all you can really ask for is be crisp. Don't make those self-inflicted errors. Don't, on offense, don't drop passes. Don't have the penalties that stop you, the drives. Same thing on defense. Don't have those penalties. Stop jumping off sides. Do those kind of things. Just be crisp. Get some of those backups some playing time. But that would then lead to, you know, the following week is Illinois, who has played well this season, Steve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll talk more about that game during that the week of it. But in essence, you've got, with the bye week, you get the 2 weeks going into Kent State, and then the third week after Kent State, which, you know, I'm already assuming is going to be a walkover. So in essence, you've got 3 weeks now to work with until you get to that Illinois game. You're the Penn State coaching staff. What are you working on over these 3 weeks?
Well, for this week, it's definitely, you know, don't play to your opponent, play to your potential, as you sort of reiterated there. But then when looking at Illinois, I think that's where we're going to have the test of the offense and defensive linemen. I sat through that 9 overtime loss, as frustrating as that was in homecoming a few years ago when Illinois came up there and won. But one, I think, thing that's reason for optimism this year as opposed to last year's, I do think the offense is much more balanced, much more explosive to that offense that we saw during that 9 overtime loss. So that's sort of what I'm willing or really want to see is, you know, have the defensive front tested. Can they hold up to that? Sort of like they did with West Virginia. I think Illinois is going to present more of a challenge. And then offensively, when Penn State has the ball, does Aller have the time? He's been very effective. I think he's been very decisive. I think Andy said last week something which I really liked. We talked about, you know, the game slowed down for him. And he sped up his decision-making. I think it's a really good way to describe it, with Aller sort of being better than expectations, at least in my opinion, so far for these first two games. But you have to give the guy time to work through those progressions still. And I think that's going to be more of a challenge for Illinois. So that's sort of the thing that I'd be watching for. You know, can you sort of just man up old school, take away their run, and can you open up holes for those running backs and give your quarterback time? It's really going to give us a better sense as to what the offensive and defensive lines are. In Bielema, I mean, he's sort of like a poor man's Jim Harbaugh. You know, he sort of recruits to a style. You know, he sort of gets guys that maybe not must be the coveted recruits, but emphasis on toughness, overachievers, and really on developing the offensive and defensive line. And, you know, I give him credit for that. Obviously, you know, Harbaugh sort of took it to another level. You talk about Connor Stallions, how much he had to do with that. But there is an identity. And I think there's something to be said for coaches that sort of, you know, have an identity and recruit to that. And it's definitely a contrast in styles that, you know, Illinois played Penn State closer than it probably should have been several years now. So,
and if you, have a coach who can create his own identity and recruit to that, it's one of the great equalizers in the game. I'm using this kind of as a segue to talk coaching with you a little bit. I think it's well established. You're not James Franklin's biggest fan, but if we look around, you know, college football this year, a lot of fascinating stories with coaches. And, you know, you got to start with the Florida schools. You know, Mike Norvell brought into Florida State. Billy Napier brought into Florida. There's a good chance by the time our listeners have put our show on, Steve, that Billy Napier could be gone, okay? It's been that bad at Florida. And Mike Norvell, to go from, you know, the 12-0, 13-0 last year to now 0-3, three games that I think going into the season, every, you know, Seminole fan thought they would win and be 3-0 at this point. How much slack, I guess, is where I'm headed, do these coaches deserve? How much patience should you be having with them? What are the things that should be prompting a change at coach?
Well, I think it depends on who you are. If you're a big dollar donor that's often asked to fund these coaches' salaries as well as their buyouts, I mean, you're probably used to, if you're making that kind of money, some return on investment desire to that, you're probably questioning that. For Napier and Novell, I think it's a little different than Franklin, who's been here for 10 years. I mean, they're still relatively early in their tenure. I'm sure there's cause for concern. Now, Florida State, if you just look at having another bowl game last year, I mean, they had all these guys not opt out, which I sort of understand, but they had a very senior laden team. So that from a talent perspective, I was always a little surprised that they were ranked as highly as they were coming into the season, just because that was a very different team from a roster perspective than it was the prior year. That said, it's Florida State. I mean, they shouldn't be losing to Georgia Tech and Boston College and teams like that, and then now Memphis. So, you know, I understand that the frustration there with the boosters. With Napier, you know, I think sort of the second year, hoping for their perspective, a little better direction of things. I think there's reason for skepticism now. But if you listen to the national shows, some people were anticipating this, and a lot of people were sort of linking if Penn State doesn't perform as well as they should this year, that Franklin's name could be potentially rumored to Florida. So, you know, I don't have much to stock to place in that, but that's something that I've heard from several of the national shows. So just something to consider.
Well, I think a lot of that comes from, it's been a couple years now where James Franklin name keeps coming up. We saw it a few years back with the USC thing, his agent doing his job, you know, using those other opportunities as leverage. And, you know, I look at this and I wonder, are schools and alums getting too impatient? I saw it was fascinating, the talking heads nationally. I think James Franklin's name will come up all the time. We got the coach at Ole Miss. His name comes up quite a bit for the Florida job also, because Florida, it can be an attractive job. It's a Southeast Conference team. It's a blue blood. It's in the state of Florida. So it's, you know, the heart of the best recruiting area perhaps in the country. So, yeah, that's a team that you think has the potential to be a national champion. My question becomes, you know, that's why Brian Kelly left Notre Dame to go to LSU. I think LSU has not been bad, but they're already talking about getting rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, look, the argument I've heard for Franklin going to Florida is, you know, if you look into his buyout here at Penn State after this year, it starts to go down a little bit versus if he goes to Florida, he could sort of reset the clock, reset the market. I know we've talked before heading into this season that this is really sort of the make or break year in terms of making the playoffs, just because a lot of this coveted class, a lot of those guys are presumably going to go to the NFL after this season. Next year's schedule, I think objectively, is more difficult than this year's. So maybe there's something to that. Again, that's sort of what the national argument is for Franklin to go to Florida. I'm not saying he will. I'm not saying he won't. We'll see how a lot will depend, I think, on this year.
And by the way, Lane Kiffin was the name I was looking from Ole Miss. And it's kind of with that idea, again, like Brian Kelly going Notre Dame to LSU. I want a chance to win a national championship. And, you know,
I think with Kelly, too, I mean, at this point, that might be an analogous situation where there was some frustration there with the donors, is sort of like, has Kelly taken as far as he can? And look, I think Franklin maybe come off as critical. I guess my sort of criticism at this point would be, I think he's sort of taken the team about as far as he can. And, you know, is there an opportunity for somebody to maybe take the team further? You know, I don't know. And again, I hope I'm proved wrong. But at this point, you know, we just sort of, I think, caught in this plateau situation. And that's, you know, risky because, you know, if you gamble on somebody else, you could take a step back. That said, if you're serious about making a step forward, you know, you may have to take a chance there. And again, that can be risky. And what I don't understand now, and maybe we'll understand moving forward, is NIL and what that means for recruiting. But one of Franklin's biggest assets has been he's somebody you can recruit to Penn State. You sort of contrast that we talked about earlier about teams with identities and Harbaugh. He didn't really go after and try to out recruit because he knew Eastman from a talent perspective wasn't going to recruit the guys necessarily that Ohio State was in Georgia and Alabama. But he sort of had, again, this identity, recruited people to that, and was able to win. Now, I know Connor Stallions may have played a large part in that. but still, you know, I'll give him some, you know, that was a strategy that he had. And so that's what I've sort of look is, you know, is there maybe another strategy now? Maybe with NIL, it's less emphasis on the coach that can get the recruits. A lot of them are, at least big-name guys, just sort of driven by the money. Maybe, again, you should look for a coach with a greater emphasis on developing the schemes and the strategy that maybe could maybe do more with less. And so that's where I look at guys like a Matt Rhule or even, you know, Boston College with Bill O'Brien. I know they lost to Missouri, but to go out there and only lose by six, they beat Florida State. I'm curious to see what they do against Michigan State. You know, I know we maybe differ on his tenure there. I was pretty high on him because I thought, you know, he really impressed me as a guy that could develop a strategy and win some games and perform well against some teams where Penn State was overmatched. To me, that, you know, I thought was very impressive.
And I understand, and there's different type coaches where I find it interesting. You mentioned Jim Harbaugh. It took him several years at Michigan. Remember, they wanted to get rid of him till things just kind of clicked, and he had a very senior team that, you know, he may have just been got out when the getting was good.
He did. I mean, it sort of like reminds me a little bit now of the NCAA basketball tournament where you have these teams where, you know, you have Kentucky, the one and dones, all the high profile, you know, guys that come there and make a lot of money versus these, you know, senior land teams that sort of, you know, watch out for them, particularly if they have an offensive line like that. I think that was something that Michigan did to their credit last year. They guys that probably could have gone to the NFL, their collective stepped up, said, you know, let's keep this team together. We have an opportunity if we do to do some things, and you're going to get a bigger payday on the back end. And you know, it worked. Again, setting Connor Stallions aside, which I don't think is insignificant, but you know, I get recruiting this identity and things. I mean, look, at the end of the day, if you're going to get into a collective arms race against Ohio State and Georgia and Alabama's of the world, that's going to be difficult for Penn State if that's how they want to compete. Versus, do you want to try to take a different path there? Maybe it doesn't have to be the exact path that Michigan took, but you know, maybe just thinking about it that way.
All right. That's going to have to be the last word. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.